she counted all her cards again, before sending Mary up to Mr. Doran's room to say that she wished to speak with him. She felt sure she would win. He was a serious young man, not rakish or loud-voiced like the others. If it had been Mr. Sheridan or Mr. Meade or Bantam Lyons, her task would have been much harder. She did not think he would face publicity. All the lodgers in the house knew something of the affair. Details had been invented by some. Besides, he had been employed for 13 years in a great Catholic wine merchant's office, and publicity would mean for him perhaps the loss of his sit. Whereas, if he agreed, all might be well. She knew he had a good screw, for one thing, and she suspected he had a bit of stuff put by. Nearly the half hour, she stood up and surveyed herself in the pier glass. The decisive expression of her great florid face satisfied her, and she thought of some mothers she knew who could not get their daughters off their hands. Mr. Doran was very anxious indeed this Sunday morning. He had made 2 attempts to shave, but his hand had been so unsteady that he had been obliged to desist. 3 days' reddish beard fringed his jaws, and every 2 or 3 minutes a mist gathered on his glasses so that he had to take them off and polish them with his pocket handkerchief. The recollection of his confession of the night before was a cause of acute pain to him. The priest had drawn out every ridiculous detail of the affair, and in the end had so magnified his sin that he was almost thankful at being afforded a loophole of reparation. The harm was done. What could he do now but marry her, or run away? He could not brazen it out. The affair would be sure to be talked of. His employer would be certain to hear of it. Dublin is such a small city. Everyone knows everyone else's business. He felt his heart leap warmly in his throat as he heard, in his excited imagination, old Mr. Leonard calling out in his rasping voice, "Send Mr. Doran here, please." All his long years of service gone for nothing. All his industry and diligence thrown away. As a young man, he had sown his wild oats, of course. He had boasted of his free thinking and denied the existence of God to his companions in public houses. But that was all past and done with. Nearly. He still bought a copy of Reynolds' newspaper every week, but he attended to his religious duties and for 9/10 of the year lived a regular life. He had money enough to settle down on. It was not that. But the family would look down on her. First of all, there was her disreputable father, and then her mother's boarding house was beginning to get a certain fame. He had a notion that he was being had. He could imagine his friends talking of the affair and laughing. She was a little vulgar. Sometimes she said, "I seen," and "if I had have known." But what would grammar matter if he really loved her? He could not make up his mind whether to like her or despise her for what she had done. Of course, he had done it too. His instinct urged him to remain free, not to marry. "Once you are married, you are done for," it said. While he was sitting helplessly on the side of the bed in shirt and trousers, she tapped lightly at his door and entered. She told him all, that she had made a clean breast of it to her mother, and that her mother would speak with him that morning. She cried and threw her arms round his neck, saying, "Oh, Bob, Bob, what am I to do? What am I to do at all?" She would put an end to herself, she said. He comforted her feebly, telling her not to cry, that it would be all right, never fear. He felt against his shirt the agitation of her bosom. It was not altogether his fault that it had happened. He remembered well, with the curious patient memory of the celibate, the first casual caresses her dress, her breath, her fingers had given him. Then, late one night, as he was undressing for bed, she had tapped at his door, timidly. She wanted to relight her candle at his, for hers had been blown out by a gust. It was her bath night. She wore a loose, open combing jacket of printed flannel. Her white instep shone in the opening of her furry slippers, and the blood glowed warmly behind her perfumed skin. From her hands and wrists, too, as she lit and steadied her candle, a faint perfume arose. On nights when he came in very late, it was she who warmed up his dinner. He scarcely knew what he was eating, feeling her beside him alone, at night, in the sleeping house. And her thoughtfulness, if the night was anyway cold or wet or windy, there was sure to be a little tumbler of punch ready for him. Perhaps they could be happy together. They used to go upstairs together on tiptoe, each with a candle, and on the third landing exchange reluctant good nights. They used to kiss. He remembered well her eyes, the touch of her hand, and his delirium. But delirium passes. He echoed her phrase, applying it to himself. What am I to do? The instinct of the celibate warned him to hold back. But the sin was there. Even his sense of honour told him that reparation must be made for such a sin. While he was sitting with her on the side of the bed, Mary came to the door and said that the missus wanted to see him in the parlour. He stood up to put on his coat and waistcoat, more helpless than ever. When he was dressed, he went over to her to comfort her. It would be all right, never fear. He left her crying on the bed and moaning softly, "Oh, my God!" Going down the stairs, his glasses became so dimmed with moisture that he had to take them off and polish them. He longed to ascend through the roof and fly away to another country where he would never hear again of his trouble. And yet a force pushed him downstairs, step by step. The implacable faces of his employer and of the madam stared upon his discomfiture. On the last flight of stairs, he passed Jack Mooney, who was coming up from the pantry nursing two bottles of Bass. They saluted coldly, and the lover's eyes rested for a second or two on a thick bulldog face and a pair of thick, short arms. When he reached the foot of the stairs, he glanced up and saw Jack regarding him from the door of the return room. Suddenly, he remembered the night when one of the music hall artistes, a little blonde Londoner, had made a rather free allusion to Polly. The reunion had been almost broken up on account of Jack's violence. Everyone tried to quieten him. The music hall artiste, a little paler than usual, kept smiling and saying that there was no harm meant. But Jack kept shouting at him that if any fella tried that sort of a game on with his sister, he'd bloody well put his teeth down his throat, so he would. Polly sat for a little time on the side of the bed, crying. Then she dried her eyes and went over to the looking glass. She dipped the end of the towel in the water jug and refreshed her eyes with the cool water. She looked at herself in profile and readjusted a hairpin above her ear. Then she went back to the bed again and sat at the foot. She regarded the pillows for a long time, and the sight of them awoke in her mind secret, amiable memories. She rested the nape of her neck against the cool iron bed rail and fell into a reverie. There was no longer any perturbation visible on her face. She waited on patiently, almost cheerfully, without alarm, her memories gradually giving place to hopes and visions of the future. Her hopes and visions were so intricate that she no longer saw the white pillows on which her gaze was fixed, or remembered that she was waiting for anything. At last, she heard her mother calling. She started to her feet and ran to the banisters.
Polly! Polly!
Yes, Mama.
Come down, dear. Mr. Doran wants to speak to you.
Then she remembered what she had been waiting for.